Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is a great privilege to have with us each week a man of uncommon intelligence, particularly with respect to one part of the war for the free world that gets altogether too little attention. Well, at least it has until fairly recently, and perhaps now is beginning to see the kind of serious consideration and debate that is long overdue. And I would argue that that might be the upshot of what Donald Trump has precipitated with his announcement last week, without much advance notice, of quotas on steel and aluminum imports. Our guest for all of these thoughts and purposes is Kevin Freeman. He is one of the country's foremost experts on economic warfare. He writes a blog on the subject, globaleconomicwarfare.com. He is a chartered financial analyst by training, but the author of two extraordinarily important books on the economic warfare topic, one, Secret Weapon, the other, Game Plan. Kevin, it is always a delight to have you with us, but especially in the aftermath of the president's announcement last week. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. Great to be here.
So what are we to make of this, Kevin? The president announced, as I say, without any advance warning that I know of, that there would be 25% import quotas on steel and 10% on aluminum. Many, particularly in the mainstream press and political elite, have roundly denounced him for doing this. Could you just describe why what the president has done may be absolutely warranted, and where do you think we're going to go from here?
Frank, the disagreement comes between Wall Street and national security, and that's something that occasionally there's an alignment, but most of the time Wall Street represents itself as the capital of the world financially and doesn't think of itself in American national interests. And so Wall Street perspective is that free trade is always good and we should always be the freest of free trade. And if you take a more nationalist perspective and say the United States is a leader of the free world, but we have to have a nation in order to function in that role, you decide that there are some industries that are critical to national security, steel and aluminum being among those, technology being another one. And if you recognize the reality of that, then you have to protect those industries. And I think that's what the president's saying and doing. And that's the objections are is, oh, no. We've got to be a one world, free world, and Wall Street's the capital.
Let me put this in a slightly different way and see if this is consistent with what you've just said, Kevin Freeman. We are encouraged to believe that it's not just one world, but it's one global market, and that as long as people can sell goods and services freely back and forth, that all will be well. And essentially, there is no particular importance placed on national security considerations, and that some of these trading partners may actually wish to do us harm. And in that connection, you've written extensively over the years about a book called Unrestricted Warfare, written by two then colonels, senior colonels in the People's Liberation Army. Remind us what that book taught us, Kevin, and how it, well, confronts, I guess, very directly this notion that free trade uber alles.
In fact, you summed it up quite nicely. And this is what I learned from Unrestricted Warfare. What we see as a global marketplace our adversaries see as a battle space. And that's just real. So in Unrestricted Warfare, written in 1999, they lay out China was very small economically compared to the United States. And they said, this is a battle space. This is where we have to win and take advantage. And they talk about all of the things that we talk about, technology acquisition, whether it's by theft or purchase. They talk about trade wars and how they can manipulate the American public opinion on these things and how Wall Street will always think in economic terms, but China has to be more strategic and take advantage of the myopia of America and how we separate national security issues from economic issues. And because of that, we'll never see their activity in this direction. So it really lays out a battle plan to take over the battle space. And you see China has ascended dramatically since it was written, and they've adopted virtually everything written in it.
Yeah. And what you do with globaleconomicwarfare.com, your superb blog, Kevin Freeman, your speeches, and your forthcoming program, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, I know will be to expose the extent to which this strategy is, in fact, being implemented. And it's just one example. I'm sorry to say, even allied nations, it seems, are perfectly prepared to take advantage of our free trade mantra and do so to our detriment. Hence the president's efforts to insert some protections for industries that, as you say, manifestly have some very important national security implications. Let me ask you, Kevin, to talk about something you featured at your blog. And by the way, I'm very grateful you mentioned the program that I participated in at the Conservative Political Action Conference last week. I commend all of you to that as well. But could I just ask you to talk a little bit about this journal, which frankly I wasn't familiar with, the Qixi Journal out of Communist China. What is it, and what did you discover there recently that's very relevant to all of this?
Well, the Qixi Journal is something, actually I saw it when it came out in 2010. It is the official house organ of the Communist Party. They put official statements in this publication on a regular basis. There was an article that was written in December of that year that basically said that the U.S. was preparing for an economic war with China, and here's how China should respond, their counter strategies. And they talk about things that they thought we were doing: trade war, exchange rate war, public opinion war, anti-China campaign, military exercises, and simulated warfare. Those are what they're accusing us of doing. And then they list their counter strategies, and their counter strategies are straight from the playbook of Unrestricted Warfare. And so I brought it back up because we're talking, oh no, there's a trade war going on. Well, what would China do if they believed we were in a trade war? It's very plain. Economic warfare, financial warfare, military exercises, space war, attacking a nearby enemy, and befriending distant enemies. These things include very specifically undermining our economy, dumping holdings of debt, which Chinese holdings of debt are down 10% from their peak in 2013, not buying American debt going forward, removing the dollar's reserve currency and replacing it with the Chinese yuan. All of those things are things China has threatened to do, and we have it in writing.
And this is the really remarkable thing about it, though I understand that they have removed this particular essay from the Qixi Journal. It's nonetheless still available on the internet, and you can certainly read about it at globaleconomicwarfare.com. But Kevin, I listened the other day to Dr. Peter Navarro, who is one of President Trump's senior economic and trade advisors, a friend of this program, a great American who has been very, very critical of what the Chinese are up to and warning that we need to take steps against Chinese economic warfare in particular, but also more generally, it's sort of strategic offensive operations now increasingly manifest. I believe he was on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace yesterday. And he was very forcefully defending this quota approach and warned in specific terms that, I think he said, in 10 months' time, if there weren't some sort of measure taken like this, the American aluminum industry would be gone. Can you shed any light on that? Does that sound right to you?
You know, I don't know, but I do admire Dr. Navarro. He, as you know, the center put out a book, Warning Order, China Prepares for Conflict and Why We Must Do the Same. And I got to work with him some on that. I don't think he's making a statement lightly. I think that's absolutely critical and true, because I know the man. But I'll tell you, this is something President Trump talked about on the campaign trail. This is not new. It's not out of the blue. It was promised, and it's a part of his agenda that he told the American people he would be doing. And I have to say, I agree with it.
Well, we're going to talk more about some of the particulars here with Kevin Freeman in a special second segment with him today. Kevin, stand by. Thank you for joining us again, and more on economic warfare and how it might touch the Internet of Things and you. Right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Kevin Freeman is in the house, virtually, that is. He is, of course, our duty expert on matters involving economic warfare, and we've got some very hot topics in that domain at the moment because, among other things, the President of the United States has really brought to the fore the whole issue of whether we can continue to ignore the economic warfare of hostile nations, in fact, even some so-called friendly nations that are operating to our great detriment, as we persist in this idea that it's all about trade, and as long as we're trading, it doesn't matter if others are taking advantage of us or worse, undermining our national security capabilities, particularly as President Trump has called attention to in the steel and aluminum sectors. And Kevin, you've generally endorsed this idea, but I did want to ask you about an example of what's going on here that is underway at the moment. We're going to be talking about it with our other guests in the course of this program. And that is the possibility that the United States might allow its seed corn technology in something called the 5G space. This is a telecommunications upgrade that is now underway, moving us towards ever faster and greater capacity broadband coverage wirelessly. Before we get to it, though, I did want to ask you to just remind us what the Internet of Things is, because it rather prominently features in this conversation.
Sure. The Internet of Things, you know, 20, 25 years ago, if you had something connected to the Internet, it was your computer. And you would log on and look at email and look at websites. Today, everything we own, has a chip in it, and it connects to the Internet in some form or fashion. Whether it's our watch, well, that's obvious, an Apple Watch maybe, and so, well, I understand that, but the iron that you use to iron your clothing and your refrigerator and your camera and your television and your automobile.
I was just hearing pillows may actually be doing this too, which is giving a whole new meaning to the term pillow talk. Kevin, so everything is going to be wired wirelessly, though. It's a very, very troubling development in terms of privacy as well as security. So in this world that seems looming at the moment, everything is connected to the Internet, and those who control access to all of those things will not only, it seems, be able to influence how all of those things work, if they work at all, but also to collect intelligence, really, about our personal lives or perhaps even more sensitive things. What are the implications here from a sociological point of view, I guess I'd ask you?
Well, sociologically, if you can track and understand human behavior, which you can because everything we do is now trackable, and it poses two risks. One of them is privacy risk, which you mentioned, and so people are recognizing and they'll be marketing and selling to you and manipulating your behavior. You can literally make people behave a certain way by controlling implements and devices that they have. But more frightening is the fact that foreign governments can hack into this information. And if you think that a few Facebook ads by Russia influence the election, just imagine if they control every aspect of our lives. Even more frightening than that, you can actually cause people to die. You can cause economic crashes. You can manipulate the stock market. You can do all kinds of things if you can hack into people's devices. So the Internet of Things is frightening. And the idea that this technology is not tightly controlled, but we share it with the world readily, is even more frightening.
Yeah. And Kevin, I guess what we should know by now, for sure, based on a lot of hard experience, is that if people can exercise this kind of control or use the Internet for malevolent purposes, they will. So in the Internet of Things, you talk about refrigerators and irons and cars and pillows. Is security being built into these various connection points?
More so today than a year ago, but no. It's barely being touched upon. So someone driving by your house could probably hack into your computer via your wireless network because you have a pillow that's talking to wireless network. It opens all kinds of doors and back doors for hackers.
Well, there's a front door that seems to be being broken open at the moment. And I wanted to conclude our conversation with you, Kevin Freeman, by asking about this. We'll again be talking more about it with Gordon Chang and Richard Manning, I believe. There is a transaction that is in the offing. Just another perfect example, it seems, of the view of the United States that all of this is just business, and the view of potential adversaries that this is a great opportunity to get into our most sensitive technologies and perhaps through the Internet of Things exercise a degree of intelligence collection as well as influence that is unimaginable. Talk a little bit about this transaction, the hostile takeover now being pursued by a company called Broadcom out of Singapore, but with Chinese ties, as I understand it, aimed at a company called Qualcomm here in the United States.
Yeah, Frank, it's bad enough when our companies are cooperating and wanting to sell into foreign companies. I remember IBM sold the ThinkPad Lenovo computers to China, and now they can't be used in the Pentagon. You know, at the time it was just, oh, it's fine, it's just a business transaction. That's bad enough. Here's an example where an American company does not want to be taken over, is concerned. They're developing the 5G fifth generation network, which is, you know, we have 3G phones and 4G phones, now 5G phones. They're clearly the global leader on it. And there are all kinds of countries that would like to take over this technology and control it and dominate the future. And they don't want to be taken over. And CFIUS, which is set up to review these foreign transactions.
That's the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, of course, better known by its acronym CFIUS.
Yes. They're looking, they want to look into this, and now it's being cried foul. No, they can't look into it because any business transaction has to automatically be approved because there's money being exchanged. And that really is, I believe, a traitorous response. It's either greed or it's naivete and ignorance or it's traitor.
Listen, I'm heartened by the information that CFIUS does want to look into this. I hadn't heard that and was rather concerned that, as they have been on any number of occasions, really asleep at the switch here and were watching. I mean, they were constituted, as you know, Kevin Freeman, for the purpose of monitoring and safeguarding national security in transactions just like this. And all too often, it has been that view that, hey, well, it's just business. It isn't something we need to bother our little heads about. But it's really so sweeping in terms of its implications that if they are on top of this one, then I certainly would hope that they would be able to ensure that a hostile takeover doesn't take place as soon as I'm told tomorrow at a board meeting of Qualcomm.
Well, exactly right. This is their job, and we should applaud them for doing it. They just asked for a review, so who knows if they'll follow through and do the right thing. But at least they asked for the review. I think that's a positive step, but Wall Street's crying foul, and they're complaining about it.
Yeah. Well, they do a lot of that. And as you have so rightly pointed out, Kevin, both on this program repeatedly and in your terrific blog, globaleconomicwarfare.com, and I'm quite certain in your forthcoming important new hour-long weekly program, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, that we're going to find CFIUS is stepping up, that that it will be reformed in a way that gives it more teeth, and I hope that takes it away from the control of the Treasury Department, which, let's be honest, never saw a foreign transaction that they didn't like. So this is a time for heightened scrutiny, and certainly what the president's done with these quotas, I think, demands a broader awareness of the kind of economic warfare threats that you do such a terrific job reporting on. Kevin, come back to us again next week. Thank you for this extended conversation. We'll look forward to our visit. As always, in the meantime, check out his work at globaleconomicwarfare.com. Next up, we will speak with Gordon Chang about a U.S. carrier in Vietnam for the first time in a long time, and President for Life, Xi Jinping. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined by Gordon Chang, the recent curator, as they call it, of an important conversation at the Conservative Political Action Conference. A great friend of this program, a highly successful commentator, pundit, columnist, author, including of two very important books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, I was very privileged to have appeared with you as part of that curated panel with John Bolton and our friend Steve Moore as well. But I just wanted to salute you in particular because I thought your remarks about what a threat China really represents these days there at CPAC were particularly strong and needed. So congratulations and thanks for letting me be part of it.
Well, thanks, Frank. And I was honored to be on the panel with you. And your remarks were strong and indeed had to be heard. And I'm glad that we're getting all of your thoughts, because as you point out, we are at risk.
We are indeed. The top news maybe of the moment is the very symbolic effort of the United States to respond to some of this. So maybe we could start with that. The USS Carl Vinson, nuclear-powered aircraft carrier, and two of its escorts are in Da Nang Harbor for the first time since the United States withdrew from that harbor and South Vietnam. It's clearly the case that the Trump administration is very concerned about what the Chinese are up to, as are some of China's neighbors. Give us sort of the context for all this, and then we'll drill down on China and what it's up to at the moment that's prompting this.
Yeah, the context, as you point out, is that there's a growing relationship between the United States and Vietnam. And what's also interesting is that Vietnam is also working very closely with two of our very important friends, Japan and India. So there is this growing connection. And the one thing this says to China is that the region is now starting to coalesce to contain Chinese expansionism. And however strong the Chinese are, they're not stronger than the forces arrayed against them, because we see not only the United States with its Quad partners, Japan, India, and Australia, but also other countries are now working with the Quad. And this is an extremely good development for us.
It is. As Gordon, we were discussing with Kevin a moment ago, the Quixi Journal of the Chinese Communist Party recently put out the kind of counter strategy that the Chinese seem to have in mind, using, among other things, economic warfare, as I say, unrestricted warfare against us. To the extent that this is coming against the backdrop of clearly the very considerable consolidation of power by Xi Jinping, a nationalist with clearly ambitions well beyond his own region. Do you see in this ascendancy to what amounts to the presidency for life stature of Xi and the announced decision to greatly increase the investment in the Chinese military evidence that this is going to take a turn in terms of old-fashioned conflict, not just of the economic variety?
Oh, certainly, Frank. The Chinese military budget was today announced to increase this year 8.1%. And that number probably doesn't include acquisition costs. And acquisition costs, we know, have been going up even faster than that 8.1%. is in fact growing somewhere nominally, maybe 3%, maybe 3.5%. This shows that the Chinese military is getting bigger and bigger slice of China's resources. And this indicates the growing strength of generals and admirals in the Chinese political system. This is one of the most dangerous trends in the world today, with the Chinese military driving Beijing's external policies in extremely disturbing directions. So as you point out, this is not just economic warfare. This is not just political warfare. This could very well end up being a crisis of two militaries coming together, fighting each other. And probably if that happens, we'll get involved.
The kinetic kind, indeed. Well, if we're not the immediate target, that also is a possibility, I guess. But, Gordon, just your thoughts. You've written, of course, about the collapse of China, and I know that there's a lot of contrary indicators to this. But what does it mean, as you see it, that a fellow like Xi is now effectively a dictator without check?
The reason why this is such a critical trend is because Xi Jinping, in his 5 years as China's leader, has been pushing the country in all the wrong directions. So we see not only a much more belligerent external policy, trying to grab territory from neighbors, trying to close off the global commons, he's also closing China up. He's closing its market to foreigners. He's trying to combat the demonized foreign influences. There's no good trends in China today because of Xi Jinping. And, you know, we've seen this before, the Japanese military in the 1930s, the German military in the 1930s. This could very well be a comparable development because, as you point out, this could end up in military conflict very soon. You know, people say China doesn't want a war, but China is doing things that will provoke a war, and we've seen this in history before.
Not only that it's behaving provocatively, but it is also, it seems, taking every imaginable step to prepare for war as well, and not just war against Vietnam or even Japan or other neighbors, but against the United States Navy and our homeland. Ominous indeed. And Gordon Chang, let me talk with you about one of the other manifestations of this Chinese threat axis. That is the kind of splinter movement, if I can use an old Maoist term, that North Korea represents. As we're speaking, a South Korean delegation is in Pyongyang. It is part and parcel of the charm offensive that began with the Olympics a couple of weeks ago. What's going on there, Gordon, and what does it mean for the U.S.-South Korean partnership and security arrangements?
A high-level South Korean delegation is now meeting with Kim Jong-un, the North Korean ruler. That delegation will come to Washington and brief President Trump. What the South Koreans are trying to do is to establish a role as mediator between North Korea and the United States. This is, to me, a troubling development because we've got 28,500 service personnel on the peninsula. We're the only nation pledged to defend South Korea. And I don't know why we're trying to defend a mediator. President Moon Jae-in of South Korea is very much a person who does not believe in the United States. Fortunately, the South Korean people don't believe in their president when it comes to this issue. So it's important for us to win hearts and minds there. But there are a lot of forces in play right now. President Trump talked about the North Koreans contacting him a little while ago. There's a lot of things happening. We don't know how all of this will shake out, but it looks like this crisis could very well be coming to a head in the not too distant future. And by that, I mean the next couple months.
And coming to a head may take the form, it sounds like, Gordon, of yet another negotiation with the North Koreans, either engineered by the South Koreans and involving others or bilateral between the two of them, possibly, it seems unlikely, but possibly involving direct talks between the United States and North Korea. But we've seen this movie before. Could you just give us a quick recap on how these negotiations have worked out in the past?
The North Koreans have never honored their promises to the United States or the international community when it's come to their nuclear weapons program. I mean, they haven't honored promises at all on any issue. But this goes back to the 1980s. The Trump administration has been trying to cut off money flows to North Korea. That's having an effect. We can see it from all sorts of anecdotal evidence. And the only way that we could ever have successful discussions with the North Koreans is when they know they have no choice but to give up their weapons. They're not there yet. The Trump administration is pushing them in that direction. But we're also going to have to impose costs on North Korea's backers, primarily Moscow and Beijing. When we do that, and when we close off trade with from North Korea to the rest of the world, then we have a chance of settling this without the use of force. But we are a long way from there, Frank.
Yeah, there was an important piece, I think, on the front page of the Washington Post, if I'm not mistaken, yesterday, about North Korea's success in working with Russia to get coal sold, even as it's supposed to be sanctioned. Gordon, so much more to talk with you about. Thank you very much for joining us. And again, I salute your leadership at the Conservative Political Action Conference last week and look forward to talking with you again next week. Next up, we'll speak with Rick Manning about this transaction involving the 5G technology and what it could mean for all of us right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined by Richard Manning, a man that I admire tremendously for his acumen on a whole host of issues. He has spent much of his life in and around the swamp here in Washington, but has remained above it somehow and helped the rest of us try to figure out where are the places where you can safely tread without getting sucked into it. He is a man who has served as a lobbyist for the National Rifle Association in a previous incarnation. He has worked in the Labor Department under George W. Bush, responsible for public affairs there. He has been leading a tremendously important organization, the Americans for Limited Government, for a number of years now. He writes for The Hill and other outlets, and he is gracious to join us from time to time to talk about what's on his mind, and something very important is on his mind at the moment. And we talked a little bit about it earlier in the program with Kevin Freeman, but I wanted to drill down on the prospective hostile takeover of Qualcomm by a Singapore-based company with ties to the Chinese communist known as Broadcom. But before I get to all of that, let me just say a proper welcome. It's great to have you with us, Rick. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me, Frank.
So before we get into some of the particulars of this transaction, would you just remind us from your perspective about what's at stake here in terms of this so-called 5G technology and Qualcomm's ownership of some very important elements of it?
Well, Qualcomm developed 3G and 4G technology, so they are the ones who made it so your Apple phone is an actual Apple phone with multiple functions, like being able to see videos and things like that. So they're the ones who figured that out, and it's why all these cell phones, mobile phones work in the way they do and aren't just phones. So that's number one. That's who they are. 5G is the next step. 5G is machines talking to machines, almost in a self-controlled loop, and it's the next step in terms of artificial intelligence and this network of that's going to exist, whether we like it or not, that's going to sit there and kind of be self-contained and running. We know there's Google cars that drive around autonomous cars, and we kind of look at that as an anomaly. In 15 years, that's going to be the reality of how things are, and it's going to be the rare person who drives themselves. Qualcomm is at the center of developing that 5G technology, and they're competing with a company called Huawei out of China in terms of that development. And if Huawei wins that development race, then you know there'll be backdoors built in by the Chinese into all these systems, and as a result, things like our utility grid will be at risk because simply being able to be shut down or sped up to overheat it. So we cannot afford to allow a company outside of the United States to develop this technology because they will be able to manipulate our economic engine with a flip of the switch.
Yeah. I must say I have considerable concerns about this technology in the first place. This whole idea of an Internet of Things, call me a Luddite, but it just seems to me, Rick Manning, that it is fraught in so many ways. And a week or so ago, we had a very interesting couple of segments with some folks warning about the radiation that the 5G technology will emanate that could be another public safety problem, to say nothing of physical security or economic security or simply privacy rights being imperiled. But it's coming, I gather, almost certainly. And the question I guess you're raising is, at whose hands and with whose controls behind it? And so tell us a little bit about this company Broadcom and what it may mean in terms of actually sort of serving as a stalking horse for a very problematic Chinese company, as you say, called Huawei.
Broadcom is, first of all, in terms of the overall 5G, I share your concerns, here's the challenge. Something along these lines is going to be developed. It's already being developed. And the real question isn't whether it's going to be developed. It's whether it's going to be developed with the safeguards to make it so we don't get irradiated from it, and it's not and we don't end up essentially losing control of our own means of production based upon the internal circuitry that makes it all go. And so that's really the question here. Broadcom is a company that's more of an implementer of technology rather than an innovator. They don't have a lot of patents and things like that. They are in Singapore. They're Singapore-based. They're looking at moving their corporate headquarters here in the United States, and largely because of another deal they did, a takeover deal, which they said they'd move their corporate headquarters to the U.S. as a result of that. The challenge is that they do have a lot of business relationships with China. The question becomes, once they control the technology, once they control the patents, once they control all of the innovation and the minds that are creating the innovation out of Qualcomm, at that juncture, it becomes much more difficult to stop that technology from being transferred to the Chinese simply through a series of deals on co-branding deals in terms of Chinese products.
Yeah. And so knowing what you do, Rick Manning, about what the Chinese are up to, and again, we've been discussing that in terms of unrestricted warfare against us, economic warfare against us, a really chilling essay in the Chinese Communist Party's outlet called the Qixi Journal, that it makes it very clear that these companies, if under the control of China, this technology would almost certainly be used against us. So this raises a question. Kevin told me something I had not heard before, which is that the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States has very belatedly indicated that it would like to review this transaction, yet there is a board meeting tomorrow, which, as I understand it, all other things being equal, is likely to result in essentially Qualcomm being taken over by this, well, stalking horse for the Chinese, as I see it.
The great news is it was announced late yesterday, early today, that CFIUS has told Qualcomm to move their meeting back a month so they can review the implications of Broadcom takeover. Doesn't mean we're out of the woods. I mean, remember, CFIUS under Obama with a whole different set of players on the board. Okay, I just understand it's all the Obama people who are running it, did agree to allow 20% of our uranium to be sold to the Russians. But nonetheless, that's the board we're talking about that's doing this. It's Trump cabinet officials are on that board. And so it's a different board than the one that signed off on the uranium transfer. But it is a board that has the capacity to say no. And there's been Senator John Cornyn, Senator Tom Cotton have been very vocal in the last day or two trying to get them to take action. We've done a few things. And hopefully they will not only take a month review of this situation, but then they will take the action of denying the capacity for a Broadcom to take over Qualcomm.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, Rick Manning, and I have been a critic of CFIUS in the past. I hope that this new leadership and evident interest in this particular transaction will be the sign of it being a much more robust organization doing what it's supposed to do, which is to really assess these national security implications. But it all starts with understanding that trade is not an end-all and be-all. It's in our interest if it's in our interest, particularly in our national security interest, but not necessarily if it's not. We Thank you for sounding the alarm on this, Rick, and I want to give some measure of credit to you doing so for the intervention of Senator Cornyn and Cotton, and also my hope that we'll see it from them and from Congressman Pittenger, who is also taking an interest in CFIUS, the kinds of reforms that will give this organization more teeth and hopefully remove it from some of the sway that has been exercised to this point of Treasury, which has long considered these sorts of transactions to be all good and the national security be damned. We'll be following it closely. With your help, my friend, thank you for joining us today. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.